Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. I thank you for being here. We have one case that's going to be argued this morning. My understanding is that the attorneys have all checked in and are ready. I'd like to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel, and to my left is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. Before you begin your arguments, I'll ask the clerk to please call the case. You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Charles Alfred McKenzie, and along with Anna McKim, it's our pleasure, our privilege to represent the Navajo Nation today. I will be addressing the constitutional issues related to the Indian Child Welfare Act, and Ms. McKim will discuss the trial court's failure to make the requisite finding of good cause to depart from the placement preferences under ICWA. Let's begin with the Constitution. Article 6 of the United States Constitution requires state judges to apply the Indian Child Welfare Act as the supreme law of the land. The trial court, in his March 1, 2019 order, attempted to sidestep the federal constitutional issue by instead holding that Section 152.104 of the Texas Family Code violates the Texas Constitution. But Section 152.104 was neither mandated by Congress nor necessary to the disposition of this case. ICWA applies with or without a state enabling statute. The state interveners and intervener CB and JP claim that ICWA is unconstitutional. That claim should be rejected by this court because the Indian Child Welfare Act was lawfully enacted by Congress pursuant to the plenary authority of Congress over Indian affairs. Congress's power over Indian affairs arises from an indivisible bundle of powers similar to the federal government's powers over foreign affairs. It should not be restricted to an analysis of the Indian Commerce Clause. And indeed, the Indian Commerce Clause is distinct from the Interstate Commerce Clause, which gets more play in federal jurisprudence. But the Indian Commerce Clause is only one of the bundles of powers that Congress is relying upon when it governs Indian affairs. In Cotton Petroleum versus New Mexico in 1989, the Supreme Court made clear that the Interstate Commerce Clause is different from the Indian Commerce Clause. And it's been that way from the beginning. Both the courts and Congress have treated those clauses distinctly. And indeed, in 1790, Congress passed the Indian Trade and Intercourse Act that regulated not simply trade between the U.S. government and U.S. actors on the one hand and Indian tribes on the other, which, by the way, was an important avenue for diplomacy and keeping the peace, but also govern interactions between the peoples of the United States and peoples of a sovereign nation among various Indian tribes. And indeed, it included criminal provisions which would be stricken under the Interstate Commerce Clause under the U.S. Supreme Court's authority in United States versus Lopez. So from the beginning, the Supreme Court has viewed Congress's power, its plenary power over Indian affairs, in quite a different way. In 1832, Rochester versus Georgia, the court said that the inherent power of Congress to govern Indian affairs derives not merely from the text of the Constitution, but from its structure and from the doctrine of the law of nations. How does one government interact with another? That precedes the Constitution and is presumed when a new constitutional republic is formed adopting in the very text of the Constitution pre-existing treaties with foreign nations and with Indian tribes, but continuing to recognize that trust relationship that arises from a government-to-government relationship. More recently, in 2000...
Has the Supreme Court dealt with the issue of what it means by plenary power? In other words, if you're relying on the treaty provision of Article 6, okay, it would seem to me that that has to be individualized in terms of each treaty, okay, because it's a specific act, a specific ratification by the Senate, etc., okay? But ICWA here is a generalized provision. It's not specific to any specific treaty. Has the court ever dealt with that specific issue, the interrelationship between the Indian Commerce Act, I mean the Indian Commerce Clause, and the treaty provisions? Because one is a generalized provision, the others are all very specific. Here, there's no treaty between the Navajo Nation and the United States, which in 1849 did include the state of Texas, okay? But there's no there that didn't happen until 1849. That's individualized, but ICWA is a generalized statute that doesn't say the court's supposed to look at the individual treaties to see what, in fact, sovereignty negotiations had been made with regard to the treaty.
Right, and 1871 is an important date because in that year Congress passed a law saying that it would no longer negotiate treaties with individual nations. There were some 350 recognized Indian tribes at that point. The number is more than twice that today. Instead, they would govern using statutes much like the one we have today. Certainly this is only arising on the scene in 1978, but treaties that were pre-existing are still in place unless they've been abrogated by the parties. But since 1871, all of this exercise of plenary power, and that's why it's important when I said it's an indivisible bundle of powers, it's a recognition that the federal government has a government-to-government relationship with another nation, in this case a domestic nation.
Has that 1871 enactment ever been challenged on the grounds that are asserted in this case?
Specifically challenged, I'm not sure. I know that some of the more recent cases say that it had been blessed by the Supreme Court. In other words, the Supreme Court, for example, in Lara, 2004, says Congress's authority rests in part not upon affirmative grants of the Constitution, but upon the Constitution's adoption of pre-constitutional powers necessarily inherent in any federal government. Much like foreign relations, there isn't a provision in the Constitution that expressly gives, for example, either Congress or the President, the power to decide what foreign country is sovereign and what its capital is. But the U.S. Supreme Court said, we're going to find that power is inherently a federal power, and we're going to place it in the President in that situation. So the U.S. Supreme Court is not unfamiliar with finding powers that are inherently part of the duties of a government, particularly when there's a trust relationship between the government and various tribes that did have treaties. And even though the Treaty of 1848 and the Treaty of 1859 don't expressly deal with adoption, they do deal with children, and they also are a recognition that the tribe is becoming a dependent nation under the sovereignty of the United States, for which the United States owes it protection under the laws of nations. So that's part of where the Supreme Court is saying Congress has plenary power to regulate all of these things. And in this case, there's no question that Child YLJ is a member of the Navajo Nation. And in United States versus McGowan in 1938, the court said that Congress possesses the broad power of legislating for the protection of the Indians wherever they may be within the territory of the United States. And that's significant when you're talking about a member, citizen, if you will, of a domestic nation, the Navajo Nation, who happens to be off the lands of that nation, but is entitled to protections as a sojourner within the remaining part of the United States. And in the last couple of minutes before I turn it over to Ms. McKim, I wanted just to mention the specific context in which ICWA was adopted, a recognition by Congress that biases within the state adjudication of parental rights and adoptions were weighing negatively, disfavoring those of a different culture, particularly Indian culture. And that's the rational basis for Congress to impose its own standards on a state system for resolving these issues. But there's no commandeering because Congress didn't tell the legislatures they had to pass any laws. The issues that are imposed upon CPS workers are either minimal record-keeping requirements, making available information about where an adopted Indian child is, beyond simply the date of the adoption when the proceeding terminates, and some specific requirements that apply equally to the state and to a private actors, like the prospective adoptive family in this case. And the U.S. Supreme Court says when a requirement applies and the state is engaging in that activity that's regulated by the federal government, if it's a general application that applies to private actors as well as to the government, it doesn't violate the 10th Amendment. And at this point, I'll pass to Ms. McKim to address the good cause issue.
May it please the court. In piggybacking on what Mr. McKenzie has laid as the groundwork of why ICWA was applicable in this case, it becomes very clear that the trial court not only failed to apply ICWA, but in fact said he would clearly not apply it. So what we deal with here is now placement preferences that had no intention of following ICWA. The ICWA placement preferences are in place for two very important reasons. One being the child, the importance to the child of connection, not just with the tribe, but also with their family, and those are addressed in ICWA. But the other important factor on placement preferences is the importance to the tribe, and that is something that connects with the constitutional issues. The United States made representations to these tribes that we were going to respect them, and part of that respect has to do with fostering their ability to continue. And quite frankly, that is done through children and the traditions being passed down to the children and the importance that those hold within the tribal relationship and the tribal success in the future. So when we look at the placement preferences and how they were dealt with here, what we find is from the very beginning, the requirements were ignored. From the very first placement, there is no evidence in the record that there was a qualified expert witness. When the nation actually provided the court with its first preferred placement, the department initially ignored it. The court then issued an expedited order for that family to have the paperwork completed for the department to move the child to that placement. The department either made errors or ignored the court's orders based upon the pending Fifth Circuit case. And then we get to the trial where ultimately the preferred placements were again completely ignored. So what should the court have done with regard to those preferred placements? The placements are to give preference to a family or a tribe under various circumstances. Here we have those being in the same because the aunt is family and also a member and an active member of the tribe. So there should not have been any reason for the court, even in applying Texas law and the priority for a familial placement, to ignore that preference. But if he'd wanted to, what would have been required was a finding of good cause to deviate from the preferred placement. If you look at the very last page of the findings of fact and conclusions of law, you find a cursory statement by the trial court that if by chance ICWA is to apply, then the best interest of the child demands good cause to defer from the placement preference. That does not qualify as a grounds for deviation from a placement preference under ICWA. The guidelines are very clear that for the court to deviate, they should look for five stated circumstances or extraordinary circumstances beyond those to deviate from the preference. Only two of those were even slightly argued to the trial court, the first being the mother's preference. A parental preference is a reason or a grounds to potentially deviate from a preferred placement. And the second is the claim that the would-be family we'll call them the interveners, already had a child that was a half-sibling to the child before the court. But when you look at the specifics
I'm sorry, counsel, you've got very little time, so let me ask two questions. One, would it have been permissible for the trial court here to take into consideration the best interests of the child if, in the affidavit from the mother, that was part of her reasoning with regard to her stated preference? And I understand there might be some risk of insinuating the Holly factors, if you will, in through the affidavit process, but is that permissible, or at least what's your position with regard to that?
It could have been if it was done properly, but it was not. The regulations require that for a parent's preference to be actually weighted for the court's consideration, there have to be safeguards that the parent indicates an understanding of the placements that are available for the child, and then it leaves that to the court's discretion as to whether or not they consider that as good cause. So under these circumstances, there is no such statement in the affidavit. The mom did not come to the court to express that she understood the placements that were available at that time.
Okay, second, with regard to the final rule, it appears that the Bureau has effectively said that the Holly factors cannot, in fact, be considered. The best interest of the child cannot be considered. Where are we to draw the line when we are dealing with a member of a quasi-sovereign nation in the Navajo Nation, but also a citizen of the United States? And it appears that the Bureau has imposed a rule that essentially says, well, the fact she's a citizen doesn't matter under these circumstances. We're going to go with the presumption that the tribe has the best interest of the member at heart. In other words, what's the interaction here between the consideration of the rights of the individual member of the tribe vis-a-vis the sovereign rights or quasi-sovereign rights of the Navajo Nation in this instance?
I see that I'm out of time.
You can answer the question.
Even under Texas law, best interest considerations are constricted by the confines of the question that's before the court and the facts and circumstances before the court. So it's nothing new for there to be considerations that narrow the court's view of the ability. We may have a grandparent who would be a much better circumstance for these children in another case, but the family code requires that we find the significant impairment to the child's physical health or emotional development before we can even consider whether the grandparents would provide a better environment for the child or be in the best interest. So we already have those restrictions that we recognize in Texas law. But I think what's very important, and I think what got a bit misstated in the lower court, is the statement that best interest doesn't apply under ICWA. Best interest is in the first paragraphs of ICWA, that Congress has reviewed the circumstances that are existing when these tribes and these children run into the CPS departments of the various states. And because of that child's need, the best interest of the child, the family, and the tribe, these are the lenses by which we want you to look at the child's circumstances. And so there are still points of discretion of best interest, but they must be reviewed under the regulations, under the statutes, as they apply to Indian children. Otherwise, you have the Anglo-American best interest 4,000 square foot house, and look at all we can provide for this child, whereas the aunt lives in a two-bedroom house. That's exactly what ICWA is trying to avoid. And when you look through the findings of fact, that's what you're going to find, is we have the socioeconomic ability to provide for this child. That is the best interest factor that we're trying to avoid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Ashley Johnson, and I represent the B family. And Ms. Klusman, on behalf of the state, is going to address the constitutional questions. What I want to focus on here with you is that regardless of whether ICWA applies or whether the standard Texas best interests of the child standard applies, this child should both remain with the B family and the court's order ordering a joint managing conservatorship akin to divorced parents in this situation that does not involve divorced parents should be overturned so that YJ has an opportunity to be adopted by a stable family and grow up with two parents in a family household. The B family are currently providing a loving and nurturing home both to YJ and to her biological half-sibling, ALM, who was adopted by the B family approximately 2 to 3 years ago. The B family would also like to adopt YJ so that she can have the benefit of being raised with that biological sibling, who is the closest family member to her, who is in a position where she can be raised in that household. There's no dispute that the mother's rights here were properly terminated, and no one is challenging that. So the B family is in the position to offer YJ the opportunity to be raised with her sibling, who also has the same mother and therefore has the same connection to the tribe, and that would be in the best interest of the child. There are several significant problems with the joint managing conservatorship approach that the court applied. There are no examples that we're aware of a court applying that kind of approach in this type of situation, where you're not talking about divorced parents who want to maintain a connection to a child. You're talking about a child who needs to find parents. And to the extent that YJ remains under a joint managing conservatorship, the B family will have barriers to actually adopting her into their family. That's contrary to the fundamental goal of Texas family law, which is to find for these children the language of the code is a safe, stable, and nonviolent environment. And that fundamental goal of a stable environment for YJ to be raised on in is undermined by a situation where every year for increasing periods of time, she has to be sent to live with more distant relatives in another state for, it started off at 1 week and it goes up to 6 weeks in the summer. It's destabilizing and difficult for a young child who is currently happily being raised by the B family to be sent away from that family. The judge's goal in adopting the joint managing conservatorship, the expressed goal, was to make sure that the YJ did have a connection to the tribe. And the B family testified at trial, CB did, and there was a testimony in the record, that they were working with ALM already to the extent age appropriate it could be done with books about his Navajo culture, that type of thing. And they would do the same thing with YJ. There's no attempt by them to distance themselves from the tribe. They're simply trying to raise the children together and take the steps that are in the best interest of the children. While the court abused its discretion through the joint managing conservatorship, we believe that the court properly determined after viewing the testimony both of the great aunt and of CB, as well as the other witnesses, the court-appointed special advocate, that the best interest of the child here was for YJ to be raised in the family at a residence determined by the B family. As a result, he concluded that the same factors, the same facts that he found that led him to believe that the best interests of the child supported the B family determining her residence, also provide good cause to depart from the placement preferences of ICWA. So whether ICWA is constitutional or not, and we think it's very clear that it isn't, and Ms. Klusman will talk about that, but for this case, regardless of what standard applies, putting YJ in a situation where she is being raised with her biological half-sibling, matching the preference expressed by her mother, is the appropriate course under either standard. ICWA, the rules interpreting ICWA or applying ICWA, give two particular provisions that we think are relevant here and that provide the basis for the good cause finding. The first is the presence of a sibling bond. Since before the placement occurred, before the court's order, YJ has been visiting with ALM. There was testimony, ALM being the biological half-sibling, the brother. He is now 4, YJ is 1. There was testimony in the record that they had a natural sibling relationship, that ALM's face would light up when she was carried in the room and vice versa. He would ask about when his sister was coming back, and his sister would have the opportunity to be played with by both ALM and then the older boys, the 10-year-old and 7-year-old, who are also the siblings in the B family. In addition, The second factor of ICWA that applies here to give good cause is the mother's preference. And the mother has expressed her preference repeatedly. She knows that ALM is with the B family.
Passed their argument that that's not a proper consideration because it wasn't done in the proper form.
So two things. One is I think the presence of the sibling attachment, they don't have that argument for. You know, that there's no dispute that the biological half-sibling is in the household. And the judge did note that and rely on that. So he did not repeat but everything when he talked about good cause. But he said, for the reasons I've set forth in my prior paragraphs, you know, he finds that there's good cause.
Do you agree that the mother's preference wasn't done in the proper form under ICWA?
We agree that the procedural technicalities were not done. I think substantively the ICWA was implemented because the mother was aware of the other placement preferences, and that's the ICWA procedural requirement, that she should have signed something or made it known in front of the judge that there were other placements and she still selected the B family. There are examples of other cases which we have cited in our brief, such as Henry Enrique from the Nebraska court, where the courts find that these sort of procedural defects that are harmless, because we know the mother's view, the mother knew about the placement preferences, she expressed that view in a signed affidavit that her counsel obtained, it's harmless error effectively, and so this child needs certainty and needs stability, and so there's not a reason to reopen and send it back for something when just going through those kind of check-the-box technical requirements is not going to change the way that the good cause requirement applies here. And I do think it's important to note that even the good cause requirement, while it does specify these specific categories of examples of good cause, two of which are present here, it also says that those requirements are not limited. And there can be, the court can consider other reasons for good cause. And the court had the opportunity to hear from both CB and from the great aunt, to evaluate them, to hear about CB's home life and the life of their other children and the interaction between ALM and between YJ. And having heard that testimony, he made the determination that it would be best for YJ to be raised by her closest, in connection with her closest biological relative, which would be her half-sibling, ALM. And so I think that that determination, that constituted the best interest of the child, and also that it provided good cause to depart from the placement preferences, even assuming that they could constitutionally be applied to this child who has no connection to the reservation, is something that was within his discretion. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Beth Klusman for the Office of the Attorney General. May it please the court. YJ should be placed in a home in accordance with Texas law, which prioritizes her best interests. But under ICWA, only two facts matter. YJ has 50% Navajo blood, and her mother is a member of the Navajo Nation. Under ICWA, that's enough to tie Texas's hands and determine YJ's entire future. Congress cannot require Texas to do this. The court should hold that ICWA is unconstitutional. Now, I'd like to spend my time before the court today discussing primarily equal protection and anti-commandeering, but of course, we'll take any questions on any of the constitutional topics. Turning first to equal protection, as you know from the briefing, the key question is whether ICWA draws a political distinction or a racial distinction. And according to the Navajo Nation, Morton versus Mancari begins and answers that question, but it's not that simple. Mancari establishes that there are certain circumstances in which a tribal classification can be considered political, but it also indicated that there are circumstances which can't be. It said it could not, for example, create, or at least it would be problematic to create a blanket exemption from Indians for civil service exams. But the point that was being made in Mancari is that Indians engaged in self-government, that's permissible to draw those kinds of tribal classifications because that is that quasi-sovereign interest, Indians governing other Indians. But that's not what ICWA is. ICWA is Congress telling state courts and employees and agencies what they must do when they encounter an Indian child or a potential Indian child. So it's not about Indian self-government. We also see this when you compare Mancari with Rice versus Cayetano.
Is it not the essence of self-government to determine the community and who is a member of the community and who is not a member of the community?
Well, it does allow, the Indians are permitted to.
The Texas Constitution, even under the Republic, decided who was a citizen and who was not.
Correct, Your Honor. And ICWA and our arguments make no contention that it's not permissible for the Navajo Nation to decide who is and who is not a member. But Texas gets to decide where a child should be raised when that child comes into the Texas court system. And so we shouldn't be engaged in, essentially what ICWA does is create a racial stereotype that Indians should be raised by other Indians.
What authority does Texas have to do that? Does it not have the authority with regard to the citizenship of the child? And are we not dealing here effectively with a dual citizenship issue, which is inherently subject to federal regulation? The child's a member of the Navajo Nation. That's undisputed under the record.
Correct.
Child was born in the United States, a United States citizen, unless there's some aspect of the federal law that hasn't been explained to us in the briefing, okay? So I've got a citizen of the state of Texas by virtue of residence, but a citizen of the United States who is subject to the laws of the state of Texas due to residency, but also a member of the Navajo Nation, okay? So why is that not inherently, because of the treaty and because of the Indian Commerce Clause, why is that not inherently why Congress has plenary power to regulate when that child crosses over from being subject to the primary jurisdiction of the state of Texas, as opposed to being a member of the Navajo Nation and the self-government with regard to members of the Navajo Nation?
Well, ICWA does not change the primary jurisdiction. It still remains with the state of Texas to make that decision. It just imposes a federal standard on state-created causes of action. And so I do want to draw a distinction between the plenary power under the Commerce Clause and the equal protection argument. Even if the court had plenary power under the Commerce Clause to regulate in this area, that doesn't make this not an equal protection violation. No, under basically the arguments made by the Navajo, there is no line that the federal government could not cross as long as it's doing something favorable for Indians, and that cannot be the constitutional standard. The plenary power is not unlimited. The Supreme Court has said that. And so it is limited by other aspects of the Constitution, one of which is the Equal Protection Clause. And again, if we look at, for example, Rice versus Cayetano, where they attempted to draw sort of a they tried to create a tribe essentially out of Native Hawaiians, but because that line involved limiting what regular non-Native Hawaiians could vote for, they couldn't vote for statewide officials who would implement the state laws through a state agency. The court said, well, when you're involving other people like that, when it's a statewide issue, then you don't get to limit it to certain members of a tribe. And that's what we're looking at here. There's not a suggestion that the Navajo can provide placements for all of the Indian children. We do have to look at other people who wish to adopt and to rule out basically most of America because they're not Indians from adopting Indian children. That violates the Equal Protection Clause. It also violates the 10th Amendment because it commandeers the states. It's not a common argument you see in state courts.
Do American citizens have the right to adopt children? Is that a right?
I would not say they have the right. They have the right not to be discriminated against in their attempts to adopt, and that's actually in statute, I believe. So, or at least the children have the right not to be discriminated against. And so under the Equal Protection Clause, yes, they would have the right not to be discriminated against in those attempts.
So you're arguing that ICWA discriminates against potential adoptive parents?
Both the children and the parents, Your Honor. By judging the children on the basis of their race and assuming that if you're an Indian, you should be raised by other Indians, despite no evidence of a tribal or cultural connection whatsoever. It just assumes, if we said that about any other race, it would be immediately stricken down as an equal protection violation. Very quickly, on the anti-commandeering argument, the basic point under the anti-commandeering doctrine is Congress can regulate individuals directly, but it cannot tell states how to regulate individuals, and that's what ICWA does. It involves, of course, private individuals, Indian children, Indian parents, non-Indian parents, but it directs their relationships by telling the state what it must do. So if you just look at, for example, in this case, it required notice to the Navajo following foster care, preferences, trying to place YJ with an unrelated Navajo couple in Colorado, ignoring the biological mother's request, they're arguing, because it didn't check off all of the ICWA boxes. These are obligations that the federal government is placing on the states to comply with in order to pursue their child custody obligations. And this is not permissible. It's not preemption under Murphy versus NCAA because seven minutes goes by quickly. Unless the court has further questions, we would ask that the court hold ICWA unconstitutional.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I want to begin on the good cause issue because the trial court's findings do not find good cause to depart from the ICWA placement preferences. Instead, it's a hybrid. The trial court in conclusion number 77 concludes that best interest of the child provides good cause to place the child with CB and JB pursuant to section 1915, but it doesn't address any of the necessary guidelines. And because there's no evidence to support a finding of good cause to depart, as opposed to what is the best interest of the child alone in isolation outside of the parameters of ICWA, then the trial court abused its discretion, and this court ought to reverse and render judgment placing the child with the aunt, who was, by the way, the preferred placement of CPS as well as the Navajo Nation. So in that regard, the state agency is aligned with the Navajo Nation. With regard to...
Does not the final rule effectively give the nation veto authority with regard to non-Indian potential adoptive parents? Because none of the factors include non-Indians. Okay.
The first factor actually doesn't refer to Indians. It's an extended family member. So the first priority under ICWA is that the child be placed with an extended family member. The second priority is with other Indian families. And the court always has discretion to make a good cause finding so that the tribes would not have a veto power over the best interest of the child when viewed in the light of ICWA, which includes...
But then the rule does not the rule exclude with regard to the consideration of the good cause factors non-Indian considerations, shall we say, the Holly factors. Aren't you effectively arguing that the Holly factors can't be employed here?
No, what the guidelines are talking about is you can't simply rely upon the Holly factors in isolation. It doesn't take any of those issues completely off the table. It says to review all the things that we normally look at when determining best interest of the children through the lens of ICWA, which recognizes an inherent bias between state systems throughout the country, particularly as Congress found in 1978, and the cultural differences that might be at play in Indian families. In fact, Congress specifically found in enacting ICWA that there is no resource more vital to the continued existing and integrity of Indian tribes than their children. And Justice Birdwell, that goes right to the heart of whether this is governing the Indian tribe. Inherently, a tribe can't continue if it can't continue to protect its own children and the culture in which those children are raised. With regard to the two cases cited, the Morton versus Mancari case specifically holds, this is pre-ICWA, but it holds classifications based upon tribal membership are political classifications, not racial. And as the Texas Supreme Court held in Pigeon versus Turner just in 2017, although lower courts are not binding upon this court, lower federal courts, the U.S. Supreme Court certainly is. And so the response you get from my friend from the Office of the Attorney General is, we look at Rice in 2000, dealing with Hawaiian Natives. Rice is an opinion which affirmatively cites to Mancari favorably only to distinguish it. In Rice, the issue did not involve a recognized Indian tribe. It involved Native Hawaiians. And Rice is acknowledging that when you're dealing with one of the federally recognized tribes, Congress has plenary power. And despite what the interveners would say, it's not all bound up in the Commerce Clause. It's an indivisible bundle of rights that honors a long heritage and tradition of respecting the trust that was formed between the United States government and the Indian tribes, whether they were in existence and had treaties prior to the time Congress started legislating instead of entering treaties, or whether these laws come into effect more recently. So we would urge this court to consider its limited role with regard to the U.S. Constitution. It's bound by the holdings of the United States Supreme Court. When there are open questions, I believe that the briefing shows that they weigh in favor of continuing to apply ICWA the way Congress intended. And the trial court's last-minute effort in Conclusion 77 to throw a good cost finding in does not resolve the issue. So for those reasons, we'd ask this court to reverse and render judgment, placing the child with the preferred placement of the aunt. Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate the excellent arguments provided to us today. They've been very helpful. Your case has now been submitted, and you're free to go about your business. Thank you.
All rise.